Hello and welcome to Who Goes There, the biographical quiz that tests our panelists' knowledge of the famous through the ages, from flash-in-the-pan one-day wonders to the heavyweights of history. Now, let's meet this week's team. Joining Francis Wien is publisher-turned-author Carmen Khalil. And with Fred Housko is the writer and biographer Victoria Glendinning. Now, just a quick note about the scoring. There are 2 points for a correct answer, 1 point for anything I have to help you with, and bonus points for extra insights. Let's move to round one, which is our archive round. We'll play you recordings of famous people speaking on issues that might or might not usually concern them. And all you have to do is work out who's talking. Francis, who is using a tool simply to criticize it in this clip?
I've been asked to talk to you tonight about the gramophone and its accompanying accessory, the record. I may first tell you that I don't like the gramophone, nor its record. To me, it's an offense, of course, to the ear.
Now then, who was that speaking?
Would it have been a conductor?
Mm-hmm.
Would it have been what's his name? You know,
That one.
You know, the old... exactly. Sir Thomas Beecham.
A very good collective effort. Yes, Sir Thomas Beecham. When he liked something, he loved it. When he didn't like it, he was happy to criticise it. Once when asked if he had heard any Stockhausen, he replied, "No, but I believe I have trodden in some." Carmen, who is giving this glowing reference?
I went down to the Biograph Company and met that great director, D.W. Griffith, David Worf Griffith. To my way of thinking, he contributed more than any one individual to motion pictures.
Lillian Gish.
No.
No? What's the name of the woman who's married to Douglas Fairbanks? No.
Douglas Fairbanks Sr. does come into part of the answer.
Yes, Douglas Fairbanks Sr.'s first wife. They started United Artists. What is her name? I'm going to say Mary Lloyd, but it isn't Mary Lloyd. It's Mary...
Mary Pickford. Pickford.
Yes!
Hooray! I got it!
I'm quite worn out. It was Mary Pickford. Although she was being paid $10,000 a week, she and three other movie makers set up United Artists, as you quite properly said, in 1919, to give themselves more freedom in their work. For a bonus point, can you name the other three? This ought to be easy now.
Chaplin.
Chaplin, yes.
Douglas Fairbanks.
And?
Mary Pickford.
And there was a fourth.
W. Griffiths, I suppose.
That's right. Yeah. I think that's worth a bonus point to them and 2 points here. Well done. Victoria, who might this royal watcher be?
I was telling you yesterday, Your Majesty, after we walked from center field during the football game, I was very pleased to be seen publicly with you, because that is one of the rare occasions when there are no hecklers in the crowd.
It's one of those very cultivated American voices that are kind of more gentlemanly than any English gentleman has ever known how to be. Could it be Gore Vidal?
Can I just give you a clue in saying
yes,
North American voice?
Oh, Canada. That's why it's so different.
Pierre Trudeau.
It's Trudeau.
Good, well thought out. Trudeau was indeed flamboyant for a Canadian and was Canada's leading light in the 1970s. But for a bonus point, can you tell me who defeated Trudeau in the 1979 election to become Canada's youngest Prime Minister?
Was it Brian Mulroney?
Mulroney.
Mm-hmm.
Pearson?
It's a difficult one, this. Because nobody remembers him.
Made a big impact on
us. What became a law?
Always worth a try, Carmen. I'll tell you, it was Joe Clark. And you really shouldn't worry about not knowing him, because in the realm of anonymous Canadian prime ministers, he's probably the least well known. In fact, while he was premier, the Canadians called him Joe Who.
And for Canada, that's a joke.
Fred, listen to this and tell me who's showing off his numeracy skills.
Oh, the number's really important. I keep reading about this Indian guy that turns out like 3,000 or 4,000 pictures a minute. Or maybe it's a day.
It's slightly spaced out. Who was that, Fred?
Numbers are not really important. I keep reading about this Indian guy. It turns out 3,000 pictures a minute, or maybe it's a day.
Now, we've got it on tape, Fred. We can play it again.
I'm just running it through my own little mental tape machine here.
We've got sort of a bid from the other side.
Andy Warhol, is it?
It is Andy Warhol. It's been said that truth is stranger than fiction, and we set out to prove that in this round. It's all about fictional characters, the real people on whom they're based, and the writers who've stolen from reality in order to create fiction. Francis, Alexander Pope's mock heroic poem, The Rape of the Lock, details the trauma befalling a beautiful society lady called Belinda when she has a lock of her hair cut off. In the real incident, who had her hair cut off and who did the cutting?
Who had her hair cut off and...
And who did the cutting?
Well, it was a duchess.
A lady, yes.
Or countess, perhaps.
She was a lady. Anybody got any idea on the other side?
It's difficult. It's another reference from another play or something, like Duchess of Malfi.
No, they were real people.
No, they were... It was one of those figures like Lady Holland or someone like that.
Brissingham? Something like that.
No. I'm lost this hair,
no, I'm afraid one time you're not related to anybody. The woman who had her hair cut was Lady Arabella Fermor, and the man who did the cutting was Lord Peter. The act caused a real rift between the two families, but as Pope pointed out, what mighty contests rise from trivial things.
Yes.
Carmen, who was a porcine Uncle Joe? Or was some serious whispering
going on? There's Stalin in Animal Farm.
That's right.
And it's one of the two pigs that takes over everything, but I've completely forgotten everything else about the novel because of my loss of memory.
Napoleon, poor Carmen is suffering from a terrible degenerative thing. It's even as this program goes ahead, bits of her brain are falling off. But it's Napoleon, isn't it, who plays the part of Stalin in Animal Farm?
That's right.
Napoleon. There's also a character called Major, funnily enough, in that.
Old Major.
Old Major, yes, who had a dream.
What are the names of the two pigs, though? There's two pigs, isn't there?
Yes, tell me the name of the second pig.
Squealer?
No.
There is a pig called Squealer.
Yes, there is, but not the one who was representing, we think, Trotsky.
Oh.
You don't mean Snowball?
Yes, very good. It is, of course, George Orwell's Animal Farm. After the death of the visionary revolutionary figurehead, Old Major, isn't that pleasing, representing Lenin or possibly Marx or a combination, the ruthless Napoleon and the idealistic Snowball are engaged in a power struggle to inherit the dead leader's mantle. In Orwell's 1984, the fearsome Room 101 was also inspired by a real place. Do any of you know where Room 101 was?
Oh, the Lubyanka, well, isn't it?
Yes, wasn't it? Oh, no, it was inspired by the very building we're in today.
That's definitely a point. The very building we're in today being known as Broadcasting House or the Black Lubyanka. The original Room 101 was in this very building, Broadcasting House.
Look out for the rats, then.
It was the BBC personnel office where files were kept on all employees. Clearly, Orwell found this a particularly shadowy and sinister place, but none of us would agree about that, would we?
Of course not. We're getting paid.
Victoria, in the film Rope, Alfred Hitchcock depicts two arrogant young men who think they can literally get away with murder because of their high intelligence. On which real killers did Hitchcock base his characters?
Oh, my. This is an American murder.
Yes. Chicago, in fact.
Yeah.
This is not the In Cold Blood story, is it? The Truman Capote wrote a book about. Two young...
Can't answer that.
Are they household names?
Not exactly. But we wanted you to be challenged.
Well, indeed.
It was Chicago in May of 1924.
I don't think I can do it.
I'll tell you. It was Richard Loeb and Nathan Leopold. Well-known household names, as you said. They were the sons of wealthy parents who murdered a neighbour to display their intellectual superiority and who thought that they were too clever to be caught by detectives with inferior minds. However, they weren't as clever as they thought, and they did get caught. Fred...
Yes.
Dean Henry George Liddell was the co-author of Liddell and Scott's Greek Lexicon. But how did his daughter leave her mark on literature?
Alice Liddell.
Mm. Oh.
Yes. Tweedledum and Tweedledee. I actually have modelled for both simultaneously.
That is indeed his daughter Alice, who was, of course, the inspiration for Alice in Wonderland. Legend has it that Carol improvised the story while on a picnic with the little family. Now, for an extra point, can any of you tell me the original title of the book?
Alice's Adventures. Which book, though, are you talking about?
The one that became Alice in Wonderland.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland.
I thought it was called Experiments with LSD, actually.
Back to Andy Warhol. No, it was called Alice's Adventures Underground.
Underground.
Our next round is entitled Curriculum Vitae. Our panellists will be read four less well-known facts about a well-known person. All our teams need to do is work out who that person is. And the sooner you answer, of course, the more points you get. Francis. Can you work out whose CV this is? She was born in Coventry in 1847 and her father was a provincial actor. Her first stage appearance was when she was nine as Mamilius in The Winter's Tale. She was married to the painter G.F. Watts for only a year.
Oh, yes. It is some... Sarah Siddons.
Nope.
What's she called, that pre-Raphaelite woman? They
is it,
know.
Is it Ellen Terry?
Maddeningly.
It is Ellen Terry. Ellen Terry.
John Gielgud's
Her stage presence was such that both J.M. Barrie and George Bernard Shaw wrote parts for her, an example of which is the role of Lady Cicely Wainfleet in Captain Brassbound's Conversion. Dame Ellen Terry. Although having two illegitimate children caused outrage in polite society, she became one of the most acclaimed stage performers of her time and received the DBE in 1925.
Isn't she Gielgud's great-great-aunt or something?
Yes.
Is she Gielgud?
Yeah. She's also if not great-granny, I think, or granny.
Something like that.
Carmen, this man was born into a poor family in Salonika, Greece in 1881. He decided on a military career early in his life, and when he was at the Harbiye Staff College in Istanbul, he was nicknamed Perfect by his maths teacher because of his mathematical ability. He rose through the ranks of the army and held the rank of colonel when he led the Turkish defense of Gallipoli in 1915.
Atatürk.
Yes, very good. It was Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. In 1935, he introduced surnames to Turkey, and for a bonus point, I want you to tell me, since you got Atatürk so quickly, what does Atatürk mean in English?
Chief Potentate Turk.
I think it means freer, liberator of the Turks, doesn't it?
It is of the Turks, but this is...
Leader of the Turks, the Gaul of the Turks.
Keep going.
First man on the divan.
Atatürk. Turkish anyway, you failed to mention the most important thing about Atatürk was that he permitted the women not to wear the veil over their heads anymore and liberated them and made them ordinary members of society. He was a very remarkable man.
Indeed, I left out some clues, but that was not among them, and it should have been.
It should have been.
Unveiler of the Turks.
Unveiler of the female species.
Uncoverer of the Turks.
Very,
no,
very great man.
Atatürk simply means father of the Turks.
Father?
Mm. Oh, he must have been busy.
And in all that hot weather as well. It's been hard work.
I did say he was first man on the divan, didn't I? Oh, dear.
Victoria, your turn now. This woman was born in 1941 and brought up in the Derbyshire village of Tintwistle. After studying at the Harrow School of Art, she became a schoolteacher and married a dance hall manager. She and her husband had a son, but their marriage didn't work out, and she opened a shop in Chelsea with her lover.
Mary Quant.
Nope, but you're in the right neck of the woods. With this lover, she opened a shop which sold bondage-style punk clothes.
Oh, right, and bras on top. Yes, that's yes. 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 Vivienne Westwood.
Right, 1 point there, I think. It is Vivienne Westwood, the first lady of outrageous design. The man who she literally set up shop with was Malcolm McLaren. Who was he, do we remember?
Yeah, the old Sex Pistols and punk and dodgy acts and things
like that. Manager. Right, the former manager of the Sex Pistols. Mm. Fred, born sometime before 1346, this man was educated at St. Paul's Cathedral School and the Inner Temple before becoming a page to Elizabeth, Countess of Ulster, the wife of Lionel, Duke of Clarence.
Yeah.
1346.
Born sometime before...
Yeah.
This is not Chaucer.
Yes, very good. Despite Chaucer's later poverty, which of course happened, he always mixed in high circles, and in 1374, King Edward III granted him a pitcher of wine daily. Now, Shakespeare, of course, described music as the food of love, but this next round is going to be food for thought. This is our music round. We'll play our panellists pieces of music. All they need to do is identify who it is dedicated to, who inspired it, or what connection certain people have to it. Francis, who is figuratively blowing his own trumpet here? Hold your gun to my heart, but that dead bones. Take my baby away from home. Over that border, where have you been? Up your house and gone again. I can only suggest that Fred has been funky during that, so he may know something, Francis, I think. And I have to concentrate here.
Sort of sounds like Willie and the Hand Jive, but it also sounds Fade Away. They all sound exactly the same, those things, it occurs to me.
It's the Willie and the Hand Jive derived from it, actually. That was done by Cliff Richard.
Did Not Fade Away derive from that as well?
They did, yeah, Not Fade Away. He lived on one riff his entire musical career, actually.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to Pop Quiz. I'm glad you could all come round tonight. Do we know who it is?
It's Bo Diddley.
It is Bo Diddley. Definitely point of Fred there. Carmen, I wonder if you can tell me who this is all about. Living in a bad dream. They've forgotten all about mankind. And you, with the world made back up to the wall. Almost years ago. You were the one who imagined it all. Almost years ago. Well, Carmen, I think you're there.
Yes, but I was sort of slipped into John Lennon when really it's George Harrison, I think.
George Harrison on John Lennon.
On John Lennon.
That's right, very good. Yes, it was George Harrison's tribute to Lennon all those years ago, a recording which also featured Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr. Lennon, of course, was shot in New York on the 8th of December 1980, having just resumed his recording career after a five-year break. I wonder, though, if any of you can remember the name of the man who shot Lennon.
Mark Chapman.
Mm.
Yes, very good a point there. In the time-honoured American tradition of referring to assassins by their full names, though, like Lee Harvey Oswald and John Wilkes Booth, I suppose we should call him Mark David Chapman. Victoria, can you identify the man who inspired this cheery number by Bob Dylan? Mama put my guns in the ground. I can't shoot them anymore. That long black cloud is coming down. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
Well, we know what it is. We know it's knocking on heaven's door.
Yes. No points for that, though.
No.
It's a dark coat, so it's not Abe Lincoln, is it?
No. He was something of a young gun.
Not Billy the Kid.
Yes, it is Billy the Kid. Very good. Well guessed. Well guessed. It was about the outlaw Billy the Kid, and it was used as part of the soundtrack to the Sam Peckinpah film Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, which co-starred Bob Dylan. For a bonus point, can you tell me the name of the Bob Dylan album whose title is the name of another outlaw?
John Wesley Harding.
Yes. It was the album John Wesley Harding from 1968. Finally, Fred, have a listen to this. Can you tell me who William Tell was, Fred?
William Tell was this rather strange Swiss person. I mean, I always go along, actually, with the Orson Welles theory that, you know, you get the Medicis, you get mayhem and God knows what else, and you get the Renaissance. And then he turned around and said about the Swiss, you end up with Toblerone and cuckoo clocks. And William Tell was this character who threw off the Austrian yoke all over an apple. Now, I got a funny feeling they don't grow apples in the Alps because they're too far up. So I want to know where the apple came from.
The History of Switzerland by Johannes von Müller records how William Tell, a renowned marksman with a crossbow, was compelled to try to shoot an apple off his son's head by the Austrian governor of the district. Tell managed it, and then later on, he killed the governor, thus starting the movement that secured the independence of Switzerland from Austrian rule. Now, our next round is all about connections. I shall give our panellists the chance to find the common bond that links apparently disparate groups of historical and contemporary people. You'll see what I mean in a minute. Francis, what is the linking thread between these people? Baroness Karen Blixen, Emily Bronte, Baroness Amandine Dudevant, and Mary Ann Evans.
Well, they're all women novelists who published their books under male pseudonyms, I would say.
Perfect. For a gallop up the scoreboard, just tell me what all their pseudonyms were, would you?
Well, Blixen was Isaac Dinerson.
Correct. Right.
Which Bronte was it you said?
Emily Bronte.
Right, well, she was Ellis Bell.
Yes.
And Marianne Evans was George Eliot. And
yes.
Who was the other one?
Amandine Dudevant.
Was she Georges Sand?
Yes, she was. Well done. Definitely two full points and a bonus point for that. I don't have to read out anything else. Carmen, tell me, if you will, what's the similarity between these men, apart from the fact that they were all soldiers? Stonewall Jackson, James Wolfe, Horatio Nelson, and King Gustavus Adolphus of Sweden.
Well, the first three, certainly. Stonewall Jackson won a famous victory, don't know where. Wolfe of Canada, certainly. Wasn't he the one up in Canada? Nelson,
yes.
We know, Trafalgar and such like. But what did Gustavus Adolphus do in Sweden? Ah, what I'm thinking is that they lost portions of their anatomy in battle.
I think you're not being quite severe enough.
Severe enough.
Not quite.
They didn't lose just parts of
their
anatomy.
They died.
They lost a big number.
They died.
Lives.
Yes. One point each, I think.
Mind you, we could be pedantic here.
How?
Well, Stonewall Jackson didn't lose his life at the moment of victory. He was shot by one of his own pickets because he forgot the password at Chancellorville.
Oh, well, I forgot that point.
They went, who goes there? And he went, it's me. They went, yeah, shut up, bang.
Wow.
Don't tell me you're the Queen of Sheba, yeah.
I didn't know Wolfe. Well, I wasn't quite convinced that Wolfe died in battle. I thought he was rather victorious, but never mind.
Well, so was Nelson. He won the Battle of Trafalgar.
They all won
died
battles,
in the process.
But they died during those battles. Mm. Except, as Fred said quite rightly, Thomas Stonewall Jackson, he was shot by one of his own men, and he died 8 days later of pneumonia, which is a bit
rough.
Victoria.
Yes.
Tell me, please, if you will, what the link is between these men. William Pitt the Younger, Lord Castlereagh, George Canning, and the Duke of Wellington.
Well, they were difficult times, weren't they? difficult chaps.
It requires two people to
yeah,
do
Yeah, they all were involved in duels.
Yes, very
but
good.
But I don't know whether they...
They were all involved in duels. Despite being leading politicians, they were all happy to go at it with their opponents on the field of honour. In fact, while Castlereagh was Minister for War, he fought a duel with George Canning, and Wellington was Prime Minister when he duelled with the Earl of Winchelsea. Fred, here's a selection of people for you to connect. Eric Clapton and Jack Bruce of the rock group Cream.
Yeah.
Mick Taylor of the Rolling Stones. And John McVie and Peter Green from Fleetwood Mac. The question is, who's the man to whom they're all connected? Pretty impressive crowd.
Alexis Corner?
No, who's the man they were all connected with at
I
one
thought
time?
It was Alexis Corner and the Blues Band.
No.
All of them. Clapton was with Keith Relf and the others. Oh, what was the band? They played... oh, I can't believe
it's
it.
One man who had that band, and his name was in the title of that band.
I can't think of it. It's just gone completely.
Francis, you going to have a go?
John Mayle.
Yes!
John Mayle,
well
yes.
They were all in John Mayle's Blues Breakers, weren't they?
That's right. It was the blues legend, John Mayle. He himself was an excellent blues pianist, singer and harmonica player, but his choice of band members during the mid-60s reads like a dictionary of rock, doesn't it? Now, it's fair to say that a lot of people would like their name to go down in history, but sometimes their name lives on while they themselves are forgotten. This round is all about those forgotten people. Francis, the Ford Pontiac is a make of car. But who was the man behind the name Pontiac?
Oh, dear, oh, dear. Isn't he the one that Coppola made a film about once? Oh, they know.
I think Indian chief.
We think he was the American Indian chief.
He was indeed a North American Indian chief. Well done. He was chief of the Ottawa Indians in the mid-18th century. In 1763, he besieged Detroit, now, of course, the Motor City, from May until October, and the feat's been remembered in the form of a rather tacky car, really. It's not very nice for him, is it? Carmen, where might you come across the name of the 17th century antiquarian and royalist Elias Ashmole? Mm.
The Ashmolean Library or Museum.
That's right.
Yes.
Very good. It's Oxford, of course, and the Ashmolean Museum. Ashmole bequeathed an historical museum to the University of Oxford, but who knows how much more he could have left had his collections of 9,000 coins and medals not been destroyed by fire in 1679. Victoria. Under what name did the Henry rifle gain greater fame and immortality for the man it was renamed after?
It's quite interesting. You never think of guns having names, really, do you? Like, who's Bren? You know?
Someone's ugly sister by the sound of it.
I only know one kind of rifle. It's called the Winchester.
Yes, it's the right answer. It was named after the American industrialist Oliver Winchester. It was first produced, though, in 1860 as the Henry rifle, named after its designer, B.T. Henry. But Mr. Winchester bought the company, and although Henry continued to design his rifles, they were given his boss's name. Well, that's the end of the round, and it brings us also to the end of the show. And a look at the scores shows me that Francis and Carmen have a very creditable 25, but Fred and Victoria have roared ahead with 31. Well done. It just remains for me to thank all our panellists, Francis Wien, Carmen Khalil, Victoria Glendinning and Fred Housegoe.